Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck. Or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
I'm waiting for an elevator.
Yeah.
And up comes Mark Cuban.
No.
And he's not with anybody. He's just by himself. And I look at him like, I know the guy. I do not know him. And I'm like, what are you doing here? And he's like, you know, he's like, yeah, you know me. He's like, and he's acting like he knows me. He's like, you know, he's like, you know me. I was like, I got business everywhere. And I'm like, all right. So it's taken a long time for this elevator to come. And so finally, I just kind of look and I'm like, what the hell? I'm like, hey, man, I'm like, you know something? You should run. And he starts laughing. And I'm like, no, I'm serious. You should run. We need somebody like you in this race.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Trailblaze. This is another week where we talk about the presidential campaign of 2028, far, far in advance. So how you doing today, Matt?
I am doing great. You want to introduce our guest?
Yeah. Joining us today is Rodel Mullineau. Rodel, for those of you who don't know him, he runs an outfit called Rock Strategies. And he also, though, was a senior access communications director for Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, who was not an insignificant figure in the Democratic pantheon of stars. You know, those of us who remember when Democrats used to win elections, a lot of that was because of Senator Harry Reid. So we're excited to have Rodel. Hey, Rodel.
Good old days. Hey, how are y'all doing?
Good. Good to have you. So listen, let's just jump in. It's a big week. I think it'd be wrong for us to start this week without having at least a moment to talk about Jesse Jackson. Reverend Jesse Jackson died, and we, of those of us who are in politics today, actually have a lot to thank him for, because his runs for president in 1984 and 1988, as we can talk about his whole civil rights career, knowing Martin Luther King and all of that, we could talk about that, but his runs for president in 1984 and 1988 really changed the way that Democrats nominated presidents. And it also brought a whole host of figures, people that we know today, into Democratic political life. And a lot of those people are the ones who really, you know, did a really great job and built institutions that we all now use and benefit from. So, Matt, you've been at the DNC. One of the big things that Reverend Jackson is known for is after his 1988 run, he changed the way we nominated presidents. Is that right?
It is exactly right. I think Reverend Jackson made things a lot more fair and allowed underrepresented candidates to have more of a say in the primary process. You know, I think if you think back to 1988, you know, Reverend Jackson finished second in that race to Michael Dukakis. But to look at the people that he was able to best in that race, so future President and Vice President Joe Biden, future Vice President Al Gore, Dick Gephardt, the longtime House leader from Missouri, Gary Hart was in that race. I mean, so he was able to win, I think, 13 to 15 contests, amass 7 million votes, and a ton of delegates to go to that convention was really well done. And what he did specifically in terms of the rules, that the way that the convention works is, prior to 1988, states were doing lots and lots of different things. There were some winner-take-all primaries. So if you got the most votes in a primary, you got all the delegates. There were states where it would go congressional district by congressional district. And if you won a congressional district, you got all the delegates. Even if you won by, you know, 5, 10, a couple thousand votes, you'd get all those delegates. And so what Reverend Jackson saw was he got like something like 55% of the vote in Michigan, but there were places where he only got, you know, 12 to 50. I think he won 20% overall of the delegates what he deserved. And there were places where he was only getting 11%, and it wasn't fair. So when
go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sure. Well, when I get it, what I saw, just to be short, there were some states where you had to reach a 20% threshold in order to get your proportionality, and they lowered it after 1988 to 15%. Is that right? Is that how it works?
That is right. And so what happened was when he was at the end of the campaign, in order to endorse Michael Dukakis, after it looked like when it was clear he did not have enough delegates to win the nomination himself, he cut a deal with the Dukakis campaign that said, I will endorse you. I will speak on the floor of the convention in support of your candidacy, but we need to make some changes, some fundamental changes to the way that we elect a nominee. So one of them was to get rid of the winner-take-all states straight across. No more winner-take-all in Democratic primary contests. That exists to today. The other thing was to lower the threshold from 20% to 15% in order to win delegates. And just a little bit of like, this may be too much minutia, but so
no,
thresholds...
here, never too much minutia here at Trouble.
Thresholds on their own are a good thing. The Democratic Party does not want to have 47 candidates roll into the convention with delegates and have this huge food fight on the floor of the committee. You want it controlled. You want people to feel that they've been represented, but that it's controlled. Like, delegates actually have quite a bit of power. They can change kind of procedural rules. They can cause problems. So, like, for instance, in 1988, the other person that Michael Dukakis and Jesse Jackson best was David Duke, the Ku Klux Klan leader. He was running for the Democratic nomination. Now, thresholds eliminate people who do not have any chance to win the nomination, but just want to cause problems. So you want a threshold there. The problem is that the 20% threshold was a little too high. It allowed people to kind of put their thumb on the scale of who they wanted to be the nominee, and it led to underrepresentation of large groups of voters in the Democratic Party. And it was brought down to 15%, which is not perfect, but it was a lot better than it was.
Yeah, and just to get some scope, in 1984, Jackson got about 3.3 million votes. In 1988, he got 6.9 million votes. So, I mean, he really was barnstorming. And I think, as you said, people like Barack Obama were able to benefit from these changes going forward in 2008. And I'll just add this. There are a few people who we all came to know who really became nationally prominent because of the Jesse Jackson campaigns for president. One of them was Ron Brown. Ron Brown helped run Jesse Jackson's 1988 convention. And so that's where he really came into big prominence in the Democratic Party. He then became the first African-American Democratic Party chair immediately after that campaign in 1988. And then Bill Clinton made him the first Commerce Secretary. And some might argue he sort of ran the Commerce Department kind of like it was the Secretary of State for business. That he really legitimized the idea that African Americans could play a big, broad role in economic policymaking in the United States. So that was also a precursor to, I think, the Obama era. And then there are people who we all know, people like Mignon Moore, Donna Brazile, who ran Al Gore's campaign in 2000. Mignon Moore was the President Clinton's one of his chief political advisors and is still around in Democratic politics. And Leah Daughtry, who Matt Butler knows really well, who has run like every institution in the Democratic Party over the last 20 years at some point.
Yeah. And also people like John Norris, who was John Kerry's kind of state director in Iowa. So I got to know him and he was able to deliver that. But yeah, I mean, Mignon gave me my first job in politics. And then Leah Daughtry has given me my best jobs in politics. So I absolutely am a benefactor from the kind of the people who came up under Jesse Jackson.
And Laura Quinn, who helped start Catalyst. She was on the 1988 Jesse Jackson campaign, and she helped start Catalyst, which then became kind of a revolutionary kind of digital targeting organization for Democratic Party and progressive candidates. There are a few of these organizations now, but they were very early in that game. So we do see like that campaign really did spawn a lot of people. And I think there's one more friend of ours who was involved in that campaign who's not here, Donnie Fowler. Donnie Fowler, I think, was in the Iowa Jesse Jackson campaign operations. So, lots of folks who we care about.
Amazing.
And So I don't know, Rodell. Rodell's here. Again, Rodell used to work for Harry Reid, a bunch of other Democratic senators, and help people get elected to office, a surprising thing in the Democratic Party. what are your reflections on Jesse Jackson today?
You know, it's for, I think, people of a certain age, and I think the three of us are all of a certain age. I mean, Jesse Jackson does embody the civil rights movement. I know that he stood on the shoulders of Martin Luther King and, you know, and the others that came before him. But, you know, when I think about the civil rights movement, for me, it starts with Jesse Jackson as someone who I knew and who I could relate to, and someone who, you think about these two races, and I think that there are parallels even today about the kind of candidates, the disruptor candidate, the, wait, hold on, Jesse Jackson's running for president? Yeah, sure, okay, ha ha ha. And the next thing you know, it's like, oh, holy shit, like he's actually, like this is a legitimate candidate. There are voices and people out there that the quote unquote establishment has, you know, forgotten or is marginalized. And he brought those people together and ran two amazing races, came up short, but paved the way 20 some odd years later for a person like Barack Obama to come out once again out of nowhere, who is this state senator, so on and so forth, you know, who doesn't have a chance among some of the others, you know, including Hillary Clinton, who ran in that race and then, you know, defied odds and, you know, was one of the greatest presidents, at least in my opinion, to ever live. So I think that there is a lot of gratitude that we owe Jesse Jackson. Can I tell one funny Jesse Jackson story?
Please.
It's actually the only funny Jesse Jackson story that I have. So this is going back to, and I might be getting the dates, it's probably 2009 or 2010. This book came out called Game Change. Mm-hmm. And
Game Change was about that election cycle, the 2008 mm-hmm. Presidential election cycle.
Yeah. I had not read the early book or so on and so forth. And there's a lot of back and forth, and I don't want to get into it, but there had been an interview between Harry Reid and Mark Halperin. And in that interview, Harry Reid, God bless his soul, who is oftentimes inartful, had said something about Barack Obama to the extent that one of the reasons why he was successful was that he was light-skinned and did not have a Negro dialect. And yes, more or less that he was saying that he was like, he was a very safe... Matt, you're looking at me like you don't remember this.
It's still kind of painful.
Jamal remembers this. Mm-hmm. But, so anyway, he said this. It wasn't supposed to end up in the book. It ended up in the book. And that's a whole other story about how it ended up in the book and how I came to find out about it after. But it's there. And then part of my job was cleanup of that. And part of that cleanup, we're reaching out to certain members of the civil rights movement who knew Harry Reid, who had worked with Harry Reid to marshal some support and some air cover while he was writing this out. And one of the people that I had to reach out to was Jesse Jackson. And I remember the conversation, and it was a short conversation, and it was, you know, Reverend Jackson, you know, so on and so forth. This happened, you know, you and Senator Reid have always had a good relationship. This is what he meant. And he kind of cut me off, and he said, you know, he's not wrong, but he's not the person that should be saying that. And I was like, yes, sir. And he's like, don't worry. He's like, I'll put out a statement and so on and so forth. But that was that. So anyway, that is my Jesse Jackson story.
So my funny Jesse Jackson story, which is nowhere near as profound, was in 1996. In 1996, the Democratic Convention, I was the official timekeeper for the Democratic Convention. I was like 24 years old, 25 years old. And 24. And this... I'm sitting there on stage and all the people get up and speak. And my job is to like, you got a green light when people have enough time, they got 3 minutes or whatever. When they get to like 2 minutes, 30 seconds, you give them the yellow light for the last 30 seconds. When they get to like the end of the thing, 3 minutes, you give them the red light, let them know. If they keep going, you flash the red light at them several times so that they learn to stop. So I'm sitting there, Jesse Jackson gets up to do his speech. He comes to the podium. He has like one piece of paper. He's the only person who doesn't have anything loaded in the teleprompter. So we have no idea what he's going to say. So he comes up with one piece of paper with like just some scribbled notes on it. I saw it when he had it in his hand, like an envelope, like the back of an envelope. Mm-hmm. And he gets up there and he starts talking and he goes on like 2 minutes happens, 2:30. I give him the yellow light. 3 minutes comes. I give him the red light. 3 minutes, 30 seconds go. I flash the red light. 5 minutes later, I'm flashing. And then I hear this voice come over my earpiece that says, Jamal, stop flashing the light at Reverend Jackson.
Jamal, that's like the equivalent of trying to do like walk off music at the Oscars for like Sidney Poitier.
Absolutely.
Like you just gotta let that man speak.
Yeah. And he must have gone for, it had to be like 12 minutes, right? He was supposed to talk for 3 or 4. He blew it by 2-3 times his allotted time. And everybody just sat back and relaxed. Literally, people just sat back in their chairs and like put their papers down and watched the speech because it was gonna do what he was gonna do.
That's awesome.
All right. So, one thing we talk about here, obviously, Rodell, we are focused on the presidential campaign and Jesse Jackson, mm-hmm. as we just mentioned, really helped us create the modern presidential nominating process. But we got some big names that are out there right now that they had a week. They were off in Munich last week at the Munich Security Conference. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, AOC, and Gavin Newsom both were out there making a little bit of news. Did you follow any of that at all?
I read the stories. Yeah. I saw the blowback from AOC's comments, and I have thoughts, but
ooh, thoughts.
Well, we want to hear them.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think she got a little blowback in particular about not standing up fast enough, strong enough about defending Taiwan if China were to attack. And maybe the general take being that she wasn't quite ready for the Q&A when she gave her talk. Her talk was fine, but she wasn't quite ready for the Q&A when that happened. Do you agree?
I'd say this. Our current president of the United States had no foreign policy experience except for whatever business deals that he had with the Russians that he now says that he didn't have beforehand or whatnot. But his whole entire campaign on foreign policy was that I've made deals with titans of industry. I can go in and make a deal with Putin and with Xi Jinping and whomever else, and that's my foreign policy. Like, let's not sit here and somehow say that Trump was reading binders, foreign policy binders, and being coached up by the smartest foreign policy minds on the conservative side. He wasn't. He went in there and he winged it, and he gets graded on the curve. I would say that
that's turned out really well. It's really turned out very well.
So now that we've gotten that out of the way, I look at it and I look at it in two different ways. I want my next president to have much more foreign policy experience than President Trump had going into it. I certainly want my president to seem to appear to have more foreign policy experience than what AOC showed in her first take here. But I'll give her a little bit of grace.
Yeah.
This is now we know what the floor is.
Yeah.
Right? We know what the floor is. So now we've got time to go to the ceiling. The second piece of this too is that my biggest thought is that, in the pantheon of where I am or the three of us are in the Democratic Party, what I think really doesn't matter. And the primary voters, there are 90-some-odd% of primary voters are never going to see this clip of her at the Munich Security Conference. Most of them didn't read the New York Times story about it. They didn't see it on CNN. They're certainly not seeing, the conservatives on Fox and others just gleefully sharing it and whatnot. So by the time this becomes, by the time we actually get to the action, I think this will be long gone. But it does show, I think it's a cautionary tale. Right. I oftentimes think that Democrats get graded on a different level than Republicans do, especially on issues like the military and on foreign policy. So yeah, there's some studying that needs to get done. I do think that her overall, what she was trying to do while she was there, which was kind of a more of a working class populist message, was completely overrun by the fact that she was by that Taiwan answer. But I'll also say this too, and I'm just once again just kind of giving a little bit of grace.
Yeah.
It wasn't the actual answer that she stumbled. It was the confidence, right? Mm-hmm. Because the answer itself, and I'm sorry, I think this kind of goes to whether, you know, who the president is. If you were to ask Donald Trump that same question, he would filibuster for 30, 40 seconds too, because the answer is, and I don't know this for a fact, but if China was to roll into Taiwan tomorrow, I don't think Donald Trump or Pete Hegseth or what have you would do anything. I honestly don't. I really do not believe that they would do anything. I would like to think that Joe Biden, the president, former President Joe Biden, was at least saying the right things and positioning us in a way that he would do something. But we don't know that either. We've been tiptoeing and playing this dance here for 30 some odd years that if China were to ever roll into Taiwan, you better not do that because America is going to do something. I don't know if we're in a position to actually do that. And that's, no one wants to say the quiet part out loud. So, you know, give AOC... Like I said, she deserves a little bit of blowback. She should have been a little bit more prepared. But the actual answer and the policy piece itself, I don't think is any different. I don't think that where she is any different than what Trump has been saying, than what Biden has been saying, or what Obama said before that, or so on or so forth.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal, $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
I think you're probably right. I think there is something to the strategic ambiguity of letting China think like, oh, we don't know what America might do. And here's the part that frustrates me about Donald Trump. I mean, the one thing on this topic that frustrates me, because I can be frustrated about everything, is, you know, he's this like big, bad swinging dick all the time about like what he's going to do around the world. And then when it comes time to actually stand up for it to a country that he can fight him back, he's like, yeah, you know, well, you know, we'll see. You know, he's like totally retiring.
In the words of the poet philosopher Jay-Z, wouldn't crush a grape in a fruit fight. So, yeah.
I don't know. Matt, so what did you think about AOC's trip over there, Munich?
Yeah, look, I think this is, AOC is young. She has not been doing this that long. I mean, I think this is one of the interesting things about what the campaign does, is it teaches these politicians how to be better politicians. Yeah. You're going to make some mistakes along the way. There's a reason that a member of Congress has not been elected to the presidency since, what did we figure a couple weeks ago?
Oh, the 1800s.
Cleveland or Garfield? Yeah, 1800s. Yeah. Like, it's not...
Garfield, you know, it was Garfield.
Garfield, yeah. Your portfolio is just not that big. So she's got a lot to learn. And look, she's going to make mistakes. I do not think this is, again, this is not fatal. This is like Wes Moore kind of a couple times ago, not getting a piece of legislation through. Like, it's this is going to happen. She's going to get better. And we'll see her go from there. What was interesting is you know, but the fact that there were so many people in Munich for the security conference, which is really a lot different than Davos, where we only had, I think, two candidates there. But, but you know, they basically, like, there was a German consultant who said, is this Iowa? What's going on here? And that same guy also said that, you know, this is international security 101 for some of these folks. And, you know, I think AOC sort of is learning a public lesson, but I think it's going to be fine. She'll be able to go on from this.
Just to put a finer point on it, I think this is a gatekeeper issue. I don't think this is a primary voter issue. And I go
say
back
what you mean
to
by gatekeeper. Say what you mean by gatekeeper.
The, you know, folks like, you know, folks like us, folks that follow this, the reporters that are, that eat, breathe, and sleep presidential politics, the consultants that eat, breathe, and sleep presidential politics, those, the consultants, so on and so forth. That's what this is about. This is not about your average South Carolina primary voter, Nevada primary voter, Iowa, or so on or so forth, that don't necessarily care about this. And I go back to a conversation that I had in, it was probably in 2019 with a very well-known consultant. We all know this person, very well-respected consultant. And we're having this conversation. I, by that point in time, had thrown my hat in the ring for Joe Biden. And, you know, it was the conversation from the other side was like, oh, God, but Joe Biden and the gaffes and all these things. And it's like, you know, you were there in the Senate with the Alito and blah, 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 and all that stuff. And I said to the person, I'm like, I was there. You reminded me. I barely remember that. And so I doubt that voters are going to care about what he did or what he said or what's, you know, stupid gaffe that he made 15 to 20 years prior, in the same way that, once again, not the greatest look from the quote unquote gatekeeper side of AOC at the conference. But I just can't imagine that your average primary voter is going to give two shits about what happened this last week in Munich.
I was nervous for a minute when you started telling that story about somebody who was complaining about Joe Biden. I was like, oh my God, is that me?
Well, this would have been 19.
We had a lunch one time where we were having this conversation, and I was like, there's no way Joe Biden can be president. You're like, no, there's no way he won't be president. We need Joe Biden. We went through the whole thing. Turned out Rodell was right. I was wrong. But also there was a pandemic. So that I use that my opposition as a asterisk because the pandemic changed everything.
I didn't listen. I believe running for president is about timing and opportunity.
Yeah.
Right. It was the right time, and it was the opportune time for somebody like Joe Biden to win the presidency. Might not have happened if there wasn't a pandemic, but where we were as a country, we needed somebody like him for that bridge. Obviously didn't work out for the next 4 years, but at that time, he was the best of the, by the way, 19 people who ran against him and couldn't knock the old man off the top. Yeah. Just remember that. He was the right person for the time.
Well, that brings us to Matt. You know, we circle back to this like almost every week. It brings us to the other person that people have been talking about who seems to be taking the pole position in this nominating contest, who is Gavin Newsom. And lots of people have things to say, lots of negatives. You know, man couldn't survive a Google search. Don't need a research book. But it seems like voters kind of starting to like him. I don't know. Rodell, what do you think?
I think people, you know, right now, I think folks are, especially left-leaning, center-left people are kind of distraught about where this country is. There are reasons why, and, you know, people get, Hakeem Jeffries catches, you know, bullets because of this. Chuck Schumer catches bullets because of this. There's just so much that we can do right now to stop Trump and this administration. The courts aren't helping us and at all. And I think what people see in Gavin Newsom, and it's not to say that, you know, California, seventh biggest economy in the world, the innovations that come out of California, there's a lot to like with what Gavin has been able to foster in California. But I think really why he's gaining traction is that he's kind of really the only one that's like, you know, fuck it. I'm just going to do and say what I think because, like, I'm not running again for governor, right? Like, you know, I'm just going to give it my shot. I'm going to troll the Trump folks. I'm going to give people I'm going to give people content that'll make them feel better for a little bit, make them forget maybe for a second the just overall shit show that we are dealing with right now. And I think that is why he is gaining traction. It's not because of any specific policy. That you go up to the average person and it's like, hey, what are his policies? And they couldn't tell you, but they will say like, hey, he's standing up. He's saying the right things. He's, you know, trying to go toe-to-toe with this guy. He's knocking Trump back on his heels a little bit. He's making MAGA world crazy, you know, and I think right now that is a good thing for the party. Now, whether or not that somehow equates into becoming our next nominee, I don't know, but it really is, like I said, like there's this void right now, and you kind of feel like this despair among a lot of Dems, and he is filling that void with something for people to cheer about.
Yeah, I got to tell you, I don't hear anybody, I've been traveling a bit the last few weeks, and I haven't heard anybody talk about issues when it comes to Democratic possible presidential candidates. Everyone talks about attributes, right? So there's like, oh, Gavin seems like a fighter. He's really out there. Could he do it? Bashir, he seems like a nice guy. Is he too nice to do it? But he's also a governor. Maybe we need a Southerner, you know, who's a governor. And then, you know, oh, what about Wes Moore? I don't know. Are we really ready to have another first time, you know, like groundbreaking person, you know, on the candidates, on the nominated ticket? Everyone's talking about attributes. Nobody's saying like, well, you know, Wes Moore really got that bridge done in time, and I really like his healthcare, you know, additive Medicare Advantage policy. Like, nobody's talking about that stuff. I don't know. Matt, are you hearing anything like that?
I agree with you completely. But that's the Trump effect, right? Like, it's more about this kind of overall vibe and attitude. And, you know, so far that's going to help Gavin Newsom, because I think a lot of his policies, while I think we may like them, are going to not play incredibly well in a general election. So, you know, making sure that the California environmental standards match what Europe is doing, like that's going to be a tough sell over this country. And there's going to be a lot of negative ads about that. Like, I'm all for it, but I don't know that everybody else is. So right now he's doing the right thing, though. I mean, we keep talking about this every week. I mean, he was on the stage at the Munich Security Conference, and he's not making gaffes. Like, he knows how to talk about this stuff. He is ready. I mean, he's running this giant state. He is putting himself on the same level as other international leaders, and just like, I completely belong to be here. The country is unstable, but California is forever. Trump is temporary. California is forever. He is doing a great job. I mean, I think you at least see, even if Newsom doesn't win the presidency, you definitely see him in a pretty major cabinet spot if the Democrats are able to win in 2028.
Yeah. So, I mean, look, the one thing he's got that you can't erase or you can't train is that guy's got ego strength. Right? That guy.
He does.
He comes in with the ego strength of being like a successful rich white dude.
As the kids would say, he's got riz. Yes. He really does. Like, if you spend any time with him, you're like, actually, you're a very charming, smart guy, you know, what have you. And you forget for a second all of those things that Matt just said, right? You know, including, you know, some of the crime issues that larger cities in California have had. Like, I mean, some of these ads make themselves. And a lot of this, once again, it's about timing and opportunity and where we are as a country during the general election. But I think Matt also made another very interesting, I think, important point. Whoever our candidate is, I hope that their story for the Democratic primary is not that dissimilar to their story for the general.
Yeah.
I'm looking for someone who can win in all time zones here, right? Someone who will solidify our party, because this is the wild, wild west right now. There are no leaders of our party, you know, all due respect to people who are leaders in the party, but there's no true leader of the party. And so we need to galvanize and bring our folks together, but also offer a message to the other half of the country, or if not even the other half of the country, the 10% or whatever of the independents that we are going to need in swing states throughout this country in order to win back the presidency. So, you know, I don't want someone who's tacking so far. I want someone to be authentic. If this is what you believe, and you know, might not be popular with everybody in the Democratic primaries, but you're going to be consistent and you're going to continue to tell the same story. You're going to 10 toes down on this is what I believe, so that by the time you get to the general, that message is still there. You haven't been wavering. I think that authenticity and that belief in your own vision and the not wavering, I think, is extremely important to winning the next presidential election.
Well, another person. Matt, sorry.
I would say that, you know, again, in terms of Newsom and how he's running this kind of early primary part, he is really doing that. He is not running as like a far left candidate intending to tack back to the middle. I mean, he's had Charlie Kirk on his podcast. He's had Ben Shapiro on his podcast. He's like, you know, gotten way out and on kind of trans sports issues. Like, this is and not in the general line of the Democratic Party or where most of the party is. So he's trying to position himself kind of as a general election candidate right now, and hoping that's going to be enough, you know, along with the Trump charisma.
So another another positioner is right now, maybe she's positioning, maybe not, but Alison Spanberger, the governor of Virginia, just won her election. She just got inaugurated in January. But already people are starting to treat her like she might be a possible presidential candidate for 2028, even though she's only been in office, has it been 30 days? I don't know if it's been maybe 45 days at the most, right?
Yeah. Yeah, certainly possible. I mean, look, I've told the story on this podcast before when Barack Obama came to campaign for us in Seattle when I was working for Maria Cantwell. It was like maybe he'd been in office for a little over a year. And, you know, they wanted the donor lists and they wanted all the activist lists who attended the events. I'm like, why do they want Washington State activist lists? Like, they're not going to run for president. That's crazy. And sure enough, by the next year, they were out there and they were running. And then he was running a very, very strong campaign. And obviously he won. So, you know, this is, as Rodell says, kind of opportunity and the time and the opportunity. If the timing is right, you know, maybe she's what we're looking for. Now, she's not in any of the prediction markets yet. So I think that'll be the first kind of real sign that people are going to start taking her seriously, that this may be happening. So look, and she's that Virginia's tough though, because it's only a one term kind of situation. Mm-hmm. So it's not like she's going to be, you know, her term will end in like a year before the 2032 race. So it's like, it's not ideal for her.
Yeah. She just got,
I could be wrong about that. I think
it's 29.
This may be the time.
It's 1 year of the, end of 29 is when her term ends.
Yeah. So she'll have a big, there'll be a decent sized gap between that and the next presidential election. And that's if we don't have an incumbent. So, you know, you gotta take your shots when you get them. So,
yeah. You know what we haven't had? We haven't had a woman run for president, who on the Democratic side, who had executive voice, right? Who was like either a CEO, a governor, a mayor, like somebody who'd actually run a big institution recently. And so I think, to me, that's been one of the markers about our, you know, Hillary Clinton, she'd been Secretary of State and a senator, but she hadn't run a state or something like that. Kamala Harris, she'd been Attorney General, she'd been Vice President, she hadn't run a state. So we just haven't had that executive profile out of one of our women candidates. And it'd be curious to me to see if that would make a difference, whether it's Gretchen Whitmer or Alison Spanberger or whoever it might be, you know, running for president right now. I don't know, Rodell, what do you think?
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them, so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app, with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Gina Raimondo, who's also in Munich. So anyway, sorry, go ahead, Rodell.
She was.
No, listen, I think that, you know, once again, just looking at these last three elections, I want, myself, I'm talking for myself specifically, I want an experienced president. I want to know that the person that's sitting at the Oval Office has done something that has some sort of relevant experience that's going to keep my family safe, that's going to make this country thrive economically, that's going to, have us as the leader in the world that we should be, and to intervene in places where we should. And but I feel as though I and many Democrats like me get we fall into this experience trap. Listen, no one is going to, Hillary Clinton was the most experienced person to ever run for president, full stop. Like, anyone can challenge me on that. I'm sorry. You know, she was, and a whole hell of a lot that did her. So, you know, there's, I think, what I want, and not speaking for you two, probably what you want, and having been in politics for as long as we've had and knowing how important some of these decisions are, why you want somebody with experience, executive, foreign policy, you want that resume. I'm not 100% sure that that is where all of the voters that we need in order to win in 2028 are. So I just don't want to fall into that trap of this person has to have checked all of the boxes in order to be sufficient to be the president of the United States, because it has, with the last 12 years has shown that that is not the case.
All right. So Rodell,
At least in, at least in two of the last three.
All right, Rodell. So, I mean, I know it's early, but who do you like? Who do you think is interesting? You don't have to be signing up to walk precincts in Iowa for him, but who do you think is interesting right now and who should we be paying attention to?
All right. So I don't have a horse. I want them all to, I'm looking for this grand battle royale because this is a once in a generation. Like, we need to have this. This fight needs to happen for the soul of the Democratic Party, for the direction. There's no one that I don't that I don't like, but this is here's my concern right now. And even if you're looking at some of the, I feel as though we are falling into the kind of like similar tropes here, right? Like, you've got the AOC character who's taken over the Bernie Sanders role, right? You've got the slick talking, charismatic governor of California who's got a great vision, but so much baggage, and you know, and that. And then, you know, you've got like your Midwestern, you know, the Gretchen Whitmer, the billionaire Illinois governor. I mean, I feel as though we're, you know, the Andy Beshear, like, looks good, but would you want to have a beer with him? Kind of, yeah. I think we're falling into all of these kind of similar tropes, and that's not to even mention like Shapiro and others, and whether or not Kamala Harris runs again. This is what I'm concerned about. It's a lot of the same. I think some of these folks are very accomplished politicians. I think they're great leaders. I think they would be great presidents. I am concerned that they are all going to run the same kind of campaigns, and that they're not forward thinking, and that the whatever comes out of it is not going to be what the American people want. Like, it's the same, and I don't mean this as any disrespect. It's going to be the same consultants. It's going to be the same. Like, if we sat here, we could tell you who's going to run these campaigns or what have you. And I'm not sure that any of them are thinking outside of the box and really kind of thinking about how this electorate has changed, and even looking at to 2032, how the math that we are using to get to 270 is changing, and are you starting to think about that now, and how are we going to expand the map and actually find a winning coalition that's going to last for more than 4 years? So with all that being said, and this is not my pick, but I am bringing this up to prove the point that I was just trying to make here.
He's been circling about the landing zone, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah. About the landing zone. About six. This was last year. So it was towards the end of last year. I'm in Washington D.C. at I'm not going to say where, but I'm in this building and I'm waiting for I'm waiting for an elevator.
Yeah,
and up comes Mark Cuban.
No.
And he's not with anybody. He's just by himself. And I look at him like, I know the guy. I do not know him. And I'm like, what are you doing here? And he's like, you know, he's like, yeah, you know me. He's like, and he's acting like he knows me. He's like, you know, he's like, you know me. I'm like, I got business everywhere. And I'm like, all right. So it's taken a long time for this elevator to come. And so finally, I just kind of look at him like, what the hell? I'm like, hey, man, I'm like, you know something? You should run. And he starts laughing. And I'm like, no, I'm serious. You should run. We need somebody like you in this race. And he's like, I'll take that in consideration. We go our separate ways. I'm not saying this because I think Mark Cuban should be our next president, but I welcome a candidacy like that in 2028. Someone who has his own authenticity, is not part of establishment politics, who is rich as hell and gives no fucks, who could actually, like, it literally is a, I could be president and probably do a lot of great things for this country, or I could not be president and be a billionaire and kind of like half run Dallas, the Mavericks or whatever position he has right now, and like and go out and do other cool things and so on and so forth, right? Someone who can bring Democrats together, but is not beholden to the party, not beholden to some of the interests of the party, and can just be authentic because he seriously has nothing to lose. Like, you know, he loses and it's not like his life is not that worse. It's like, God, I've somehow ruined my career. It's like, no, you're still a billionaire. You're going to be okay. I like that about him. And what I also like is having somebody like that in the mix forces everyone else to think differently and to not run the same cookie cutter campaigns that I am fearful that we are going to see in 2028. So what I'm kind of getting at is I'm all for the disruptors, not necessarily because we need a disruptor as president, but I think we need a disruptor to shake things up.
All right. That sounds like a plan.
Makes a lot of sense. I like it. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, guys, this was a good time to hang out. Rodell, I'm glad you joined us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was awesome.
All right, so we'll talk to you again later. Thanks, everybody, for being on Trailblaze. We will see you next week.